And good morning and welcome to this April 27th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we're always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access our podcast later in the hour. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors, not only about their books, but about their writing process, creativity, craft, all the things that go into creating compelling fiction. And when it's possible, it doesn't always work, but when it does, it's really nice to book authors who have a nice synergy, something that links them up in some way. And I think today is one of those days. Both of my guests this morning focus on the immigrant experience coming to the U.S. with, you know, all the hopes and fears and expectations and misunderstandings. One from India, one from Russia, but united in this sort of experience of America from the outside perspective. Boris Fishman joins me in the second half to talk about his latest Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo. But first, Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni is with me. Chitra is an award-winning and best-selling author, poet, activist, and teacher of writing. She's written 17 books, including a book books for young readers, short story collections, literary fiction, and poetry. Her work has been published in over 50 magazines, including The Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker. Her writing has been included in over 50 anthologies, including The Best American Short Stories, The O. Henry Prize Stories, The Pushcart Prize Anthology, and translated into 29 languages. Several of her works have been made into films and plays. She lives and teaches in Houston. Her latest novel is Before We Visit the Goddess. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's my huge pleasure to welcome her. Chitra, welcome.
Thank you so much. It is great to be on your show again.
Well, I have to tell you, so I have been a fan of your work since the 90s with Mistress of Spices and Sister of My Heart, which it was another lifetime for me and another career. And I wasn't paying attention to writers necessarily. I was just paying attention to books that I fell in love with. And so I lost you for this period of time. And then I stumbled on your short story this summer in One Story. Then I forgot that I had read it back in the 90s and kind of didn't make the connection. And then when I booked you on the show without making the connection in my head again, I came upon the short story in the novel. And so I feel like I keep meeting you again and again and falling in love with your world again and again and then realizing it's been you all along. And
well, thank you. What a beautiful compliment. Which, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I really, really love your work. And I love all fiction coming out of the Indian experience, and you know it's just so rich and so lovely and so layered. And your work has been doing that for all of these years. So before we dive into this novel, I thought maybe so you've been writing for decades, and I just kind of wanted to get your perspective of what has captured your interest over the long course of your work. And then how your work has changed over time, do you think, where your areas of interest and areas of concern have changed?
Well, I think one of the areas that really inspired me to become a writer is immigration. I love telling immigrant stories because that's such a big part of my life. I think immigration truly transformed my life. I came to America at a very impressionable age. I was 19. I came here for graduate studies, but my path to education was a thorny one because all of a sudden I didn't have money to go to school and I had to work at all kinds of odd jobs. And I looked around and I saw, immigration in my life and the lives of people like me. It was at once transformative. It was at once a great adventure. It was also very scary. And it was very confusing because all of a sudden I was in a world where the rules are different, and all of that made for very rich writing material for me to explore in stories and novels and truly over the years, because immigration continues to change and the new immigrants who are coming are facing different kinds of challenges and also experiencing new kinds of exhilaration.
Yeah. And what do you think has changed over time? I feel like your characters have really almost grown up with you, that, back in the 90s, they were young women, Sisters of My Heart, young friend women. And then over time, it feels like the women have matured with you and, you know, there are more mother-daughter relationships, grandmother-granddaughter relationships. And I was wondering if that was your experience as well, if you feel like these characters have grown and evolved with you.
Well, I think, you know, that's a very accurate observation because, yes, my earlier main characters, the protagonists, were in general younger. And now in Before We Visit the Goddess, it is the three-generational, actually four-generational, because we have Durga, and then we have her daughter, Savitri, we have her daughter, Bela, and we have her daughter, Tara. So there's like four generations. And this novel, Before We Visit the Goddess, is really about heritage, among other things, how women pass on important lessons, both positive and negative ones, their values, their ways of seeing the world, but also their prejudices, how they pass them on to the next generation. So, yes, I have a lot of older women in this book, but I also have Tara, who is, you know, she's a teenager when the book begins. She's very rebellious. She is very unlike my other characters. I was quite delighted to write her because, you know, she's tattooed and pierced, and she has decided to cut herself off, at least for a large chunk of the novel, from the Indian community.
Right, right. No, she was great. She was great.
Thank you.
I loved her. So let's kind of get into the novel a little bit more and talk a little bit about the structure of it. So it's a novel told in stories, and you would still call it a novel, but I'd love to get your thoughts on whether you think there's a distinction between a novel told in stories and interlinked short stories that, you know, where all the characters kind of reappear, and talk a little bit about structuring it.
Sure. That's a great question, because structure was at the heart of this book. I really wanted to set myself a new challenge. As you know, I've written stories before and I've written novels, but I've never written a novel in stories. And it was a wonderful, exhilarating form. I found it challenging, but also very freeing, because I could write about the lives of really three generations, even four, but it was very agile, because I could move from one important moment in the life of one character to perhaps the life of a whole other character and a very different crucial moment in that life. And it is definitely a novel because there's an arc connecting it. And I knew when I started that there would be a beginning point and what that would be. And it would set up a challenge, a conflict, as well as a conundrum. And by the end of the novel, that would be solved or resolved in some way. So I knew that overall structure. I didn't know what would come in between. And I knew I wanted it to be a symphony of voices. Hmm. So I think that very strong overall structure moving through these three generations is what makes it for me a novel in stories and not connected stories. Mm-hmm. And all of the stories are, I think, thematically connected as well through these three lives. So
yeah, absolutely.
That was something I was working on.
Is that how you wrote it? Did you write it chronologically so that you got from, you know, beginning to conundrum to end resolution?
No. And as I started writing it, you know, I had the idea of the arc, but I put it in the back of my mind. And really the way I've structured this story is not always chronological, but it's based on emotional resonance. I felt that I was moving from emotion to emotion, and the emotions were all connected. And there was often a lot of, in my mind, at least, a lot of paradox and a lot of irony between one story and another. And we would see the effect of one story upon another, but maybe that effect would manifest like 20 years later.
So great.
But I wanted to place those stories close to each other so that the reader would see that.
And I was trying to figure out if, you know, the story that appeared in one story over the summer, Durga Sweets, is certainly a standalone story. And I was trying to figure out if that would be true of the other ones as I was reading them. And I think it is. I mean, I think you could pull any of these stories out and have it be a standalone work, as well as work in the orchestra of the rest of the novel.
Well, I really wanted that. I'm not sure that everyone would work, because there are references in the stories to others, but I really did want each one to be like a complete experience, kind of a little capsule in itself.
Right, right. No, it's masterful. It's really masterful. So let's take some of these characters out and talk about fleshing out their voices. Medical history is one example of a story told in from the male point of view, which is just, I think, as strong of your male perspective as any of the women are. So let's
thank you so much because I really worked on those voices. I think actually I've worked harder on this novel than any novel before this. So
is that right?
I really hope that comes through.
It really does. And you know, I mean, it's hard to take on so many characters and their voices and have them be fully realized. So let's talk a little bit about that process and how you accessed Sanjay and got his voice so very strong and right.
Well, in that story, Medical History, I wanted to play with some... I wanted to play with form. I've been in this novel. I've been playing with a number of different forms. So Durga Sweets that you talk about, you know, that form is that story goes backwards in time, because we want to get finally at the moment that started it all for the narrator of that story.
Right.
And in Medical History, Sanjay, who is Bela's husband and whom we have seen until now only through the eyes of the women, and therefore he is definitely a colorful but kind of almost, we could say, a villainous character. He has caused a lot of angst in his family because of things that he's done that we won't give away. But now he is much older, and he's in the doctor's office because he's having medical problems, and they've given him this form to fill out, and through the form he thinks back on his life. And we will discover why he does the things he does.
Which is such a great device. I mean, I want to put a device. Device sounds contrived, and it doesn't feel contrived whatsoever. But it's such a wonderful way to access this character through medical history forms. And like you said, in Durga Sweets, where it moves backwards through time, this play with structure, I think, is very interesting. And each story presents a new sort of challenge for you, I think, in how to lay it out.
Yes, I really worked on those structures, and I have to say something, which is that I think I was really able to push myself beyond what I'd ever done before, because I have a wonderful writers group, and they're very encouraging, but they're also very stringent. So they went over these forms with me, and they were like, they pointed out things, and they made me push it to another level. So, you know, since this is a show of writers on writing, I just wanted to put out a plug for working with groups. I think if we have a writers group, they just help us see things in our stories that we can't see. And this is the first time I've really worked with a writers group in writing this novel, and it was very helpful.
At what point do you decide to show your work to the other writers? How far along do you have it before you get input from them?
I have to have it to where it's the best that I can make it.
Okay.
And then I show it to others.
Okay.
Yeah. And for me, that's just what works.
And so I assume that they read the stories individually and then commented on it as the whole arc of the stories working together.
Yes, exactly.
That's wonderful.
Yes, and, you know, I would do the same for them and the pieces that they're working on.
Right. That's wonderful. Yeah, those writers groups are absolutely invaluable. We push those. I don't know how you feel about MFA programs. I know you teach. Do you find a huge value in people pursuing an MFA?
I do. And a part of it is that, you know, I personally did not go through an MFA writing. I came to writing an MFA writing program. I came to writing late. I had already finished all my formal education. I was already teaching literature in college. So I had to learn things the hard way. Books became my greatest teachers. That's not a bad route to go, but it took me a long time. I had to figure out, you know, I had to make mistakes, and I had to figure out that those were mistakes, and then I had to correct them. In the MFA program, you bring your work to, you know, to the workshop and to the professor who's teaching, who's a working writer, himself or herself, and everything happens very quickly. You are able to see things because you're, you know, your workshop people and your professor point out things to you. right away it's clear to you, these are the strengths, these are the weaknesses. The learning curve becomes very steep and very quick.
Right, right. So go MFA. We live on a campus here that has a wonderful MFA program, so it's
that's true.
It's around us all the time. Yeah, it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
Yes, it is a good thing.
You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Chitra Banerjee Devakaruni, and the book we are talking about is Before We Visit the Goddess. We can't certainly talk about this book without talking about the landscape and the sense of setting and place, and all of that is so rich in across all of your novels, but certainly this one is no exception. And I would love to hear your thoughts on writing from a place where you are not. And I think some of your characters have followed you around. I know that you've moved around the U.S. a little bit, and your characters have ended up in Texas where you are. So maybe talk a little bit about writing from where you are and then writing from where you are not, and the difference between those two experiences.
Yeah, that's a very good question, because this book has both of them. So Before We Visit the Goddess begins in a place that I'm not. Which is, it begins in India, where I'm not at this point, but also with the story of the grandmother Savitri, it begins in a time that I never was, because she's the generation before me. So I had to do a lot of research on Kolkata, the city in which her adventures truly begin and where things happen that are going to change her life forever. And I really had to do a lot of research on Kolkata. I had to talk to a lot of people. I had to get hold of old pictures. It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. And I remembered that my own mother has passed away, but I remembered stories that she would tell me about Kolkata. And that was, so that was a place where I was not, just in terms of time. And then now that I'm living here, there are stories that are set in more contemporary Kolkata, and I'm not there either. But I do know that city. So it's kind of a recollection. It's a kind of reimagining. It's all kinds of things. Some of those stories, Bela, who is more of my contemporary, Savitri's daughter, she goes to college kind of at a time when I also went to college in Kolkata. So there's some reminiscing over there, although her life is very different from mine. Much more exciting and adventurous, if we are to compare. And then Tara, of course, is living in contemporary America. She's living in Texas. And I really wanted to put Texas into this book. This is my first book where Texas features prominently. And, it takes me a long time before I can write about a place. Now I've been in Texas for a decade, and I think I understand. At least I understand the cities in which Before We Visit the Goddess is set, which is Houston, where I now live, and Austin, where I have a lot of friends, and both my boys went to college over there. So I know that city well, too.
I think that's an interesting culture of how long you need, or question of how long you need to live someplace to really understand the nuances of it, and whether or not it's safe to write about a place where you really have never inhabited and only visited. I think every city is sort of layers of an onion, where you deepen your understanding of it over time, so what a rich life that you got to be in all these places. That's great.
Well, I think you are so right. And different writers are very different about this. But I feel I have to live in a place for a while and soak in the ambience. And that's why I lived in California for many years before I started writing, period. So California is where I really came of age as a writer. But so after I moved to Texas, for years, I would have the American parts of my book were still set in California. And people were like, wait, you don't even live there anymore. But I'd say, I still live it inside of myself.
Yeah, right.
If that makes sense.
It does. It does. And I also think that being away from a place almost gives you a better perspective on it than being in it. You can see it from distant eyes, which I think allows you to see things that you can't see when you're walking the streets every day. And so that can only help, I think, in writing about Calcutta, perhaps.
I think that has been very true. Because, when I was in India, I never wrote. I never thought I had a story. I was so immersed in the place that I had no perspective.
Yeah.
It was only after moving to America that I could, at least as a writer, that I could even see India. if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you wouldn't see that a funeral pyre is a strange thing if you're in it every day. And then as American readers, we're like, wow, that's amazing.
Right. I think distance gives you that perspective.
Yeah.
It's still very intimate for you because you've lived it, but now you see it as others would see it too. And I think a writer who's lived in more places than one kind of inhabits that gap between the places, looking backwards and forwards, kind of Janus-like, you know? And I think that's a good place for a writer to be. But it's also uncomfortable because you realize now suddenly you no longer have a home in the way where someone who's never left a place has a home.
Right, right.
But that's valuable for writers.
That's valuable.
For
right.
us, I think it's good to be uncomfortable sometimes for us writers.
Indeed, indeed. And good to be able to experience the human condition from a number of different angles, which I think if you've stayed in the same place your whole life, it's more difficult to do that. Not impossible, but more difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we can't really talk about the immigrant experience without talking about cuisine and food, which features prominently in this book, throughout this book, all of your books.
Before we visit the goddess, has lots and
lots
of food.
I love it. I love it. In fact, I took it to an Indian restaurant and was reading it there. I'm like, I'm having a craving.
I'm so glad to hear that.
No sweet shop.
I really wanted people to feel food in Before We Visit the Goddess, of course, as the wonderful tactile experience that it is, but also as heritage, also as culture, also as something intergenerational that changes its nature as time goes on.
Yeah. And it strikes me as the one thing that you can bring from another place with you that is, you know, incredibly visceral and sensory, a piece of home that you can take with you wherever you go and sort of, inhabit India wherever you are.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Great.
But what is interesting, and I see this in my own kitchen, the kitchens of friends, and certainly in the book, is that the cooking will begin to change its nature. So the way I cook Indian food now is very different from how my mother used to cook it in India. And Bela, in fact, is going to she's going to experiment with all kinds of fusion cuisine, which I love to do. In fact, I have a blog in which I put up all kinds of fusion cuisine dishes.
Oh, I love it. Oh, I'm going to have to check that out. That's fantastic.
Yes. It's on my website, chitradevakaruni.com.
Perfect. All right. I spent a lot of time on your website, but clearly not enough. I have to go back. And you're on book tour. We missed you last night. You were up at Pages yesterday. But if any of our listeners are in the Bay Area, you're heading there today, yeah?
That's right. Tonight I will read at BookThink in Mountain View, then in Bookshop Santa Cruz tomorrow, and on Friday at Berkeley at BookThink in Berkeley. And Berkeley, of course, is very special for me to go back to because I went to school at the university.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I also wanted to ask you about what outside of your writing life feeds your writing life. I know you have been involved in a lot of work with domestic violence victims, and I know you teach. What would you recommend to writers outside of sitting down at their computer every day that feeds your writing the most?
Well, for me, I would say, and this is what I say to my students also, figure out what you're passionate about. And if you can write about that, if you can combine that passion and the writing, I think the writing gains a certain power and resonance. So women and the condition of women has been very important to me. You know, that's as I've worked in the field of domestic violence and abuse now for almost 30 years, that's been something I think of all the time, the importance of women being independent, the importance of a woman feeling that she's successful and that she is an entity in herself and that she has creative power. These are questions that become very important in Before We Visit the Goddess, but they've been important in my life a long time. You know, my mother was a single parent. She struggled very hard for many years to bring me up and my two younger brothers, and she was very concerned with that question. So I think these are things I feel really passionate about, and therefore they appear and reappear in the stories. If I'm not passionate about it, I wouldn't know how to make anybody else care about it in my writing.
Right. That is great. Yeah, that is great advice. Is there other advice that you'd give writers that we haven't touched on today?
Yes, my 9-word mantra.
Yeah.
Read, 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 write, 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 and edit, edit, edit. No, seriously, that's how I became a writer. I read a lot. I read like a writer with a pen in my hand, marking things down in the margins, like truly trying to steal every technique I could from the writers I admired. And then I started writing, and I make sure that, right now, of course, I'm on book tour where everything's kind of upside down. But at home, I have a regular writing regimen. I write several days a week. I've set aside several hours each day to write. And then I revise obsessively. I feel that's so important.
Yes, yes. And how do you know when you're done?
It's that point is not always clear. Sometimes you have a feeling.
Yeah.
It's like, boom, something happens inside of you and you put the story away. And sometimes my writer's group has to say to me, all right, quit messing with that story.
Done. You're done.
Yes.
So nice when somebody else tells you you're done.
Yes. But of course, that's not true because then I send it to my editor at Simon & Schuster and she will give me some more advice.
And you're not done. Yeah, right.
Yes. But at least as far as my brain is concerned, without outside advice at that point, I'm done.
Right.
I can't make it any better.
Right. I love it. Well, I've been a fan of yours for decades. I plan to be a fan of yours for more decades. I'm anxiously awaiting whatever comes out next. And this was such a huge pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Really,
it's
wonderful.
A great show.
Really wonderful. That was Chitra Divakaruni. The book is Before We Visit the Goddess. And I really recommend Chitra's website. It's just a wealth of information. She's done some really wonderful TED Talks on the power of story, the power of narrative arc, just in people's lives in general, and has done a lot of amazing work, as she said, with domestic violence. So I really recommend checking out Chitra's website. It is just wonderful. We are going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Boris Fishman will be with me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Boris Fishman is with me now. He was born in Belarus and immigrated to the U.S. in 1988 at the age of 9. His journalism, essays, and criticisms have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and Book Review, The New Republic, The Nation, on and on, other publications. Boris received a degree in Russian literature from Princeton. Afterward, he was on the editorial staff of The New Yorker and edited Wild East, Stories from the Last Frontier, published by Random House. Boris received his MFA in fiction from NYU. His first novel, A Replacement Life, published by HarperCollins, was a front cover review in the New York Times Book Review. It was also one of the New York Times 100 Notable Books of 2014, a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers pick, a Best of 2014 selection by the San Francisco Chronicle, Shakespeare & Company, and others. He was on the show with me in 2014. You can find a podcast of that interview on our website. HarperCollins has just published his next Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo. It's the subject of our chat this morning. Boris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. Thank you, Marie.
I'll have you back anytime you come out with something because these books are fabulous. And you've been really busy in the last 2 years since we talked.
Yes, I have. Though not in the way that you think. I actually wrote this one before the first one came out.
Oh, thank God, because I was like, man, he really... You said that in an interview. Go ahead.
Now it'll be a while before the third one comes out.
Yeah, I heard you say in an interview, my biggest advice to writers is to write their second book first because it's so difficult to publish your second book. And I thought you were joking, but you really did write this one before Replacement Life.
Yes, because the attention of the first book got, it's a fantasy come true. But it messes with two things. It messes with simply the time that you have available to focus on writing in an undistracted way. And also, you really have to be a monk in order to not let any of that feedback seep into sort of where the creative work happens.
Right.
And I'm by nature an extrovert. I don't write books for the drawer. I write to connect with an audience. And so I have been eager to hear what people have had to say. But it does end up leaving kind of a trace. And you need time to detox from all of that in order to sort of start thinking clearly and only for yourself, as you should when writing. And all of that was just easier to do when no one was paying attention, you know what I mean?
Right, right. That's a very good point, a very good point. So why don't you take us a little bit into this? When we talked back in 2014, A Replacement Life was very much a jumping off point from an event that had happened to you, or you know, it certainly wasn't autobiographical, but it was inspired by something. This book seems different than that. So why don't you take us into Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo and kind of what sparked the idea?
Yeah, so in a sentence, it's the story of an immigrant family in New Jersey that adopts a boy from Montana who turns out to be wild, or so they think. And it's written from the perspective of the mother, the adoptive mother. And as it proceeds, sort of becomes as much a story about who she is and who she was and who is she has sort of allowed herself to become inside this family that she's joined. Everyone in the family are immigrants from the Soviet Union, but at different times and in different ways. And for a variety of reasons described in the novel, she's essentially, in a metaphorical sense, adopted by her husband's family because hers remained back in Ukraine. And joining that family, she sort of assumes a series of roles that are conditioned and expected of Russian women that she wants to fulfill because sort of those expectations are loud and high for a woman from that part of the world. But in the process, she leaves behind a lot of the things that made her wild in the different sense of the word, just in the sense that she was an independent spirit. And all of that is sort of brought to the fore and to a head by this strange boy's arrival in their lives. And then, 8 years later, this bizarre misbehavior that begins where he runs away from home and they find him sitting face down in a river counting pebbles or eating grass or eating dirt. Anyway, this strange arrival kind of blows wide open the conflicts in their family. Everyone has taken care to keep hidden for a long time the way that families do. And everyone ends up taking a trip out to Montana to find the birth parents of the boy to get more answers about who he is. And that's where it all sort of comes to a head.
I love it. Maya is such a strong character. And I had heard you talk at one point about thinking of writing this in a first person point of view from Maya's perspective, but your grasp on the woman's experience was so incredibly strong. Talk a little bit about accessing such a strong female character and sort of the ways that pushed you as a writer.
I'm so gratified to hear that because obviously this was a departure. I wanted to do something very different. The first novel was written from the perspective of someone like me, or it was in third person, but sort of the leading consciousness was that of a young Jewish, Eastern European Jewish man in his mid-20s. So I wanted to see if I could inhabit a very different consciousness, because why are we doing this if we're not sort of pushing ourselves beyond what we're familiar with? It was also important for me because I feel like a lot of male writers that I love have done a really bad job with their female characters. They're sort of celebrated nonetheless, which really puzzles me. So I wanted to see if a man was capable of writing a three-dimensional woman character. But at the same time, one way that you can misstep is sort of just to sort of be obedient and a good citizen and sort of create a saint. And I also didn't want to do that. I wanted to create a three-dimensional human being, someone with both heroic qualities and flaws, the way that all of us are, but somebody who was clearly the product of curiosity and empathy and goodwill on my part. So that was my mission. And it's been so gratifying to hear the women who read it say what you just have. Why did I manage? I'm not sure, except for the fact that I grew up in a family of very present women. Speaking of my mother and my grandmother, these are people who gave a lot but also asked for a lot back. But the asking that they did was sort of between the lines, You know, in a Russian family, there's this kind of cult of love where everything is ostensibly for the child. And I say ostensibly because the adults are human beings, too. It's not like they don't have needs. They just have to find more creative ways of communicating them to the child than simply saying outright, I want this from you or I need this from you. And so I feel like from a young age, I was learning to sort of study these people, not so much what they were saying, but what they meant when they said what they said, which was often very different. So you can say that growing up at the knee of these people was a kind of education in womanhood. And I feel like I came out of it with some very, very classically feminine qualities. I have a kind of classically masculine appearance, but I feel like my psychology is heavily feminine in classical terms. You know, it's a little dicey to talk about this in a black and white way. And I think that's what enabled me. So that combination of both curiosity and familiarity, I think, is what enabled me to try. And the fact that it came out well that's, there's a piece of alchemy in there, too, that you sort of can't account for, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, women are so complicated in the ways they communicate. Their needs are so complicated and underhanded is not the right word, but they're certainly not as straightforward as men, and you really captured that very, very well.
Well, that's just it. And, like, for me, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's a kind of cult of simplicity in our culture, where if you sort of create complexity where ostensibly you can get away without it, that's seen as a flaw rather than as a strength. But my brain is such that I want to find the complexity in every situation rather than select the path of least resistance. I'm not looking to live the simplest life possible. I'm looking to live the truest and most interesting life possible. And it seems to me, again, speaking, you know, with some generalization, but all the same, that, like, women are much more disposed toward that than men, and that's exciting for me.
Right.
And it's part of the reason where I think most of my friends are female rather than male. That's the reason why. I just find them, on average, to be far more interesting people.
And now that I'm reordering the novels in my brain, realizing that this novel was written before Replacement Life, because it seems like the safer thing for a new novelist to do is to write something similar and closer to them. But you stepped out first and then came back to writing a more...
I should correct you. When I say I wrote it before the first one came out, but not before it was written. I wrote Replacement Life first.
Oh, I got you.
And then after I sold it, I had a little bit of time and money before it came out where I could focus on a second. So, yeah.
I'm with you.
I feel like the classic thing was true with me. You know, you really have to, in your first novel, I mean, writing a novel, there's this idea sometimes I hear it reading. So if I'm finally going to get those 2 weeks of vacation, I'll finally knock out that novel I've had going around my brain for a while, which, you know, is an amusing thing to hear because everyone can write. But writing a novel is it's no more instinctive than being an astronaut, you know? And so the first novel is really, you're just groping in the dark, in my case, for 3.5 years. So I think that's why so many people rely on stories that hit closely to their real lives, because if you have to make up this story on top of trying to figure out how to do everything else, it's so much to get your brain around. But I did do that first.
Indeed, indeed. I want to talk a little bit about your ability, which I think is masterful, to sustain suspense in a relatively quiet novel. I mean, as I was reading the first 200 pages, I'm like, well, not that much has really happened. If I was to write down plot, you know, not a ton has happened. And yet,
correct,
it's so compelling to read. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about how do you do that? How do you keep the reader's suspense aroused through relatively intellectual, you know, kind of ethereal concepts?
Yeah, that's another very good point. And it's a high challenge, especially in a literary culture where, you know, you're not really competing against sort of thriller writers, but they sort of exist in the same universe. And all the same, you know, the solution for a lot of literary writers is to just suspense isn't even a part of the game. You know, they telegraph from the beginning that this novel is going to be about something else. It's going to be about beautiful language, or it's going to be about a new sort of exploring a new literary concept. But for me, I live somewhere in the middle. I believe in beautiful writing. I believe in complex storylines. I believe in complex characters. At the same time, I do want to write the smartest possible book for the broadest possible audience. And so I want to think about the reader. I want to think about what will make the reader turn the page. And I understand that there's no international murder mystery here. But at the same time, I do think that sort of the most ordinary lives, I'm speaking about real life now, they include so many small moments of suspense and wondering and unclear outcomes. And so in this particular case, the way that I did it or tried to do it is the novel opens with Max running away. And so for the first 50, 75 pages, what I want the reader to be wondering is, like, where is this kid? Right. And what happened to him? And is he fine or not fine? And while I've got the reader hopefully wondering about that, under the cover, I've got a little cover from that particular small mystery. In the meantime, I'm feeding the reader all kinds of vegetables about who are these people, where do they come from, and I'm very gently introducing the idea that this is not a family at peace.
Yep.
This is a family with a lot of submerged friction. And by the time Max returns, which shouldn't be a mystery because otherwise I wouldn't have a novel or it would be a very different one, you realize that actually there are more things to wonder about than just whether this boy will return. And then sort of there's the next milestone mystery, which is, will they go to Montana? It's something that they argue about quite a bit. And what will they find there if they do? To them, it's a kind of, they've never been west of New Jersey, so for them, it's terra incognita. And so in these small ways, I sort of push the ball forward, hoping the reader will come along.
And it works so well. And it's really well done.
I'm thrilled to hear it. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And I wanted to talk a little bit about landscape as a character. And you know, so there's the East and the West, meaning both New Jersey and Russia, and the West meaning both the U.S. and Montana. And this pull towards the West, pull towards the landscape, and the land always is sort of a reflection of the psychological states of your characters. I've heard you yourself are being pulled towards Montana.
Yeah, it's a place that became important to me quite a while ago now. I saw a movie called Legends of the Fall, which is known better than the book that it's based on. The movie's got Brad Pitt in it. It's kind of a romantic version of what the book actually is. The book is by Jim Harrison, a great novelist and poet who recently died. Mm-hmm. But in 94, 95, when I encountered it, I was living in, we had just come to the States. In the Soviet Union, we were from Minsk, which is about as urban and concrete a place as you can imagine. Then we moved to New York City, ditto, and then to suburban New Jersey, which, you know, the highest thing in my sight line was, I don't know, something that was two or three stories. And so I actually wasn't even aware that places like Montana existed until I saw it in this movie. And you know, these are some of the mysteries of inheritance, be it genetic or cultural or environmental, that I explore in the novel. Why did that landscape speak to me in such a strong way? I literally had never been around mountains, but something about it felt incredibly liberating. Mm-hmm. You know, I came to America with a lot of expectations heaped on me as the only child of an immigrant family. I don't think I have to translate for your listeners what that's like. And so I think without even realizing it myself, I was spending my early years in America carrying around a great deal of anxiety and responsibility and stress about making right on this incredible sacrifice performed by my family. And then I see this landscape, which is empty of people, and it also has a staggering beauty to it, but everyone sees that as beautiful. It performed a different function for me. For me, the idea that floated up in my head was, there is room to inscribe yourself here. Those are actually the words that floated up to my head the first time that I actually got to see it in 2007, because that fantasy that I started having in 94 went unrequited for many years. And I think it was a place where I'm able to feel freer. I feel free of the expectations that sort of ride me hard in a place like New York. New York is such an overachieving, overperforming place. You add that to sort of the expectations that I carried as a young person here, and just you're always behind. you're always behind. And out there, there's so little around you, it's almost like a mirror, where instead of being bombarded with ideas on what you should be and what you could achieve, there's a kind of eternal silence that asks you, well, who are you and who do you want to be outside of other people's expectations of it? And for me, that was very, very liberating, and I wanted to put that into the novel as a place. I mean, ostensibly, they go out there because they want to find Max's parents. Though that's the way that Maya sells it to Alex, her husband. She just wants to see it because she's a curious person in a way that he's not. Anything new is threatening to him in a way that it isn't to her. And she's so plainly curious. What is this place that her son comes from? But when she gets there, she has a most unanticipated experience of just being blown wide open by this place where she finds it impossible to lie to herself any longer about the kind of person that she has given herself away to become over the last 20 years of marriage. And that's the experience that I have out there. You know, for a lot of people, it's a daunting place, the place that makes you feel small. For me, it has the opposite effect. It makes me feel huge. It makes me feel as huge as the mountains around me, the kind of the feeling it creates. Boris, your job is to be the best version of yourself that you can be from now forward. And who wouldn't want to be in a place that makes them feel that way? It is never the way that I feel in New York, never.
Right.
New York's job is to make you feel small. Mm-hmm. And 3 times a year for about 17 minutes apiece, you will get to feel large. In Montana, it works the reverse way, at least for me. And that's why I'm drawn to it.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, and I love this idea that there are, it doesn't matter where you're from, there are places that call to you and reveal your identity to you that have no link to either biology or nature or nurture. And the whole concept of adoption through this and adopting a new land, adopting a new family, and, you know, Maya being sort of unwillingly adopted by her in-laws. And it's just,
That's right.
The themes through here are wonderful.
And it goes go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say that it also goes for people and our relationships in life. You know, I have almost no friends who are Russian or for whom that is the primary aspect of their identity. If I have friends who are Jewish, then that is sort of, an incidental part of their identity. If we actually do the work of figuring out who we truly are without sort of giving ourselves the easy out of these categories that stand ready, I am male, I am female, I am Russian, I am Jewish, I'm a New Yorker, I'm an American, as long as you sort of and there is a comfort in having those things available to you. But as long as you sort of decline them and do the difficult work of figuring out who you really are, all sorts of opportunity for connection with new people, new places arrive. One of the best books that I've read in recent years is Jeanette Winterson's memoir, Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal.
Uh-huh.
She literally, without trying not to be a narcissist, but like that is a book, that book is about me rather than her, I say cheekily. But what do I have in common with a gay English woman living in the countryside in her 50s? Well, everything. Because right. of the way that we grew up and the kind of parents that we had and the way that we found salvation in books and blah, blah, blah. I would have never expected to sort of form that connection necessarily if I wasn't sort of aware of those parts of myself. So there's a great liberation in ignoring those categories and sort of having nothing at the ready and just sort of proceeding organically in terms of figuring out who you are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My guest this morning is Boris Fishman. The book is Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo. We're drawing down on our time, but I want to give you a couple of minutes to talk. This is a hard topic for writers to write about, our sex scenes, and you do such a masterful job. And I was wondering if you could impart any advice of how you approach very authentic, organic, wonderful sex scenes without falling into all the horrible trappings that writers often fall into.
Well, I'm thrilled beyond thrilled to hear that because that was so important for me to do. For some reason, sex has vanished from literary fiction as if it doesn't happen. Well, it still, if our job is to reflect real life as it is, then believe me, it still happens. There's just some kind of preciousness and cerebralism that has crept into and overtaken literary fiction where, there's a wonderful essay some years ago by Katie Royce talking about how sex used to be a staple of the novels of Norman Mailer and John Updike and Philip Roth, And it was actually lame because it was very objectifying the woman, but at least it was there. Whereas you look at novels by men or by young literary contemporary men or women, and it's just not there. There's sort of there's the distance of irony and sort of dancing around the issue, but people never come together and do this thing that humanity has done since the beginning of time. And so for me, it was so important to reinstate that into literary fiction, because without it, sort of things are starting to feel a little, like you said, a little ethereal and disconnected from reality in many of the new books that I pick out, because it's just not the priority there. Yeah. Secondly, you don't want it to slide into pornography and objectification, because that's false as well. And you also don't want it to be cheesy, because that's also false. So what do? Well, the solution for me was to write sex scenes that were simultaneously raunchy but tender, because for me, that's what sex has always been. It's an experience of deep intimacy that also lets out some very primal impulses, and to insist that those impulses are without a certain kind of violence, a certain kind of physicality, a certain kind of animalism, would be completely false. It would be airbrushed then. But if that's all that there is, that's also false, because, again, it's this experience in great intimacy. So for me, it's walking this tightrope between aggression and tenderness that I think where I think I find the truth about sexual experience. And I love writing those scenes, and to be sort of complimented for it is very, very fulfilling. Thank you.
Well, I'm just going to pull out one line, which I'm plucking out completely at random because this book has endless examples of this. But at the end of one of these scenes, you say they're memorizing the other to no value because memory is nothing next to the thing. And I keep lingering on that section, a sentence, because it's so true. And then I wonder, like, when you're writing, do these insights into human nature just come very organically, or do you think to yourself and jot down in a notebook while you're in a Starbucks, you know what, memory is nothing next to the actual thing itself, and I have to work that into this sex scene somehow?
Well, I do occasionally jot down insights into the characters and into the plot and into something that should probably happen or not happen, something that occurs to me, that's false, that wouldn't happen that way, or you know what, that should... Whereas these particular insights into just human experience, there's a kind of rolling openness to them that I never chronicle in an overly purposeful way. I'm generally an extremely self-analytical and self-reflective person. I have been in therapy and analysis for a very long time, and there are many writers who say it messes with their creativity. It only frees mine by virtue of I mean, the kinds of stories that I'm interested in telling are human stories about the relationships between people. That's what I care about the most. I care about how people collide and go apart and collide again. And so my daily life is filled with small sort of observations and impressions. It's what I talk about with friends. It's what I try to talk about with my parents. It's what I pay attention to in movies. And what's interesting is that the things you realize, they stay in your brain. And then you're writing a scene, and one of them will float up. It is for me sort of an incredible mystery of the creative process. It just sits there waiting for you. You've had it. It's been filed away. It's been written nowhere, and it just floats up. And when that particular line floated up, I've had many intense but ultimately unsuccessful romantic relationships in my life, and there's always that moment when you know that it's going to end. But it's not everything about it is terrible. Certain things work not only beautifully, but ethically. And so you're trying your best to memorize the good moments, but you just know that as soon as this person goes through the door, it will be worth absolutely nothing. It's like water through your fingers. It is impossible to hold on to it in any meaningful way. Uh-huh. And it's an extremely melancholy experience. It's happened to me often. I've never written it down in a notebook, but when I was writing that scene, I realized, why are you writing the scene, Boris? Well, of course you're writing the scene about this, because it's happened to you so many times, and then that just naturally comes into it, and that's the way it tends to work.
I love it. Boris Fishman, a perfect note to end on. That was wonderful. You have me hooked.
Thank you so much for asking me about that and about the things that you did. You've had me talk about a couple of things that I really care about a lot, but I'm not asked about a lot. So thank you for that.
I love it. Thank you. Thank you. That was Boris Fishman, the book, Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo, out and available now, and a fantastic read. I really encourage you to go onto Boris's website. There are endless interviews, endless information on there, borisfishman.com. That's all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.